I'd like to talk to you about some work I did with Juan Maldacena on the black hole final state. And our paper came out just a couple weeks ago on HAP 03-10-281, I guess. Okay, Juan and I started to work on this over 2 years ago. We didn't write anything up at that time because we thought it was too speculative. I still think it's pretty speculative, but Juan keeps talking about it at international meetings, so we thought it was time to put it on paper. In fact, many of you probably heard his talk at the conference here just a couple weeks ago. And I don't have anything new to say, but I gather what people want is for me to go through the idea slowly and give you the opportunity to interrupt with questions and objections and things like that. So the key question, the problem that we're addressing is black hole evaporation unitary? And as you know, the ADS-CFT correspondence gives a very strong argument that the answer is yes. After all, the process of formation and evaporation of a small black hole in an asymptotically anti-de Sitter space is supposed to be described by ordinary unitary evolution of some state in some dual conformal field theory. On the other hand, there's long-standing semi-classical arguments due to Hawking, which says the answer is no. And so this has been the puzzle for many years. I think most of us put more weight in the first than in the second. We believe the answer is yes. And so then the question is, what goes wrong with the semi-classical arguments? And our proposal is that one has to supplement the usual semi-classical arguments with a final state boundary condition at the black hole singularity. Now, of course, the semi-classical approximation breaks down at the singularity, so this is not obviously ruled out. And very roughly, you can see how this will help resolve this puzzle, because Hawking radiation can be thought of as pair creation, with one particle going out that we see and another particle falling inside the black hole. So you get this highly correlated state between the ingoing...
Can I replace the battery?
So if you've just joined us, we're talking about the black hole information puzzle. Semi-classical approximation, we claim, needs a final state boundary condition because, roughly speaking, Hawking radiation is pair creation. One particle goes out to infinity, the other particle falls into the horizon, so you get this correlated state. And one can think of this final state boundary condition as basically collapsing the state of the ingoing Hawking radiation to a state associated with that of the infalling matter which formed the black hole in the first place. That correlation then transfers that information to the outgoing Hawking radiation in a process similar to what's called quantum teleportation. Okay, yeah, question.
Do you see this final state as sort of part and parcel of the semi-classical approximation, that is, it's something you only need to put in when you're doing the semi-classical approximation, or would it be some part of the really fundamental underlying quantum theory of gravity, so that you would expect to actually, I mean, for instance, obviously it's not apparently there in ADS-CFT, it would sort of be effective.
I don't think, I mean, from what we understand of ADS-CFT, you don't need a final state boundary condition in the gauge theory or in the CFT. You have an ordinary field theory, an ordinary Hamiltonian evolution. So this is something which sort of arises and is needed in this semi-classical approximation. Okay, so outline for the rest of the talk. I'm going to start by reviewing two things that are sort of crucial for this problem. One is the original semi-classical.
Yeah. Can I just follow up on that question?
Yeah.
Is it really something that you need only in the semi-classical approximation, or is it something that you need only when you want to describe what's inside the black hole? And those could be two different things. I might want to describe what's inside the black hole from a fundamental point of view. And I would expect ABS-CFT not to tell me anything about that.
Well, that I disagree with. I believe ADS-CFT does talk about physics inside the horizon, but it's an ordinary gauge theory. So. Ordinary Hamiltonian evolution in the gauge theory, of course, corresponds to evolution in the exterior Schwarzschild time in the black hole. Okay, so you don't have anything like a final state boundary condition for that, in either case. The physics inside the horizon is something that we don't know very well how to describe in terms of the gauge theory. I certainly think it's there as part of the dual CFT, and there's been some work by Steve Schenker and others about how what to calculate in the CFT to see sign of the singularity, say, inside the horizon. It's something which is much, you know, more non-local and stuff like that in the gauge theory. But you know, I don't think the CFT should have to be supplemented by anything.
On these questions. Is it possible you need a final boundary condition in the bulk in order for the ABS-CFT correspondence to be correct?
Yes. In fact, that's exactly what we're trying to do. Okay, so I'll start off with the review of these semi-classical arguments. And also, since we're going to be imposing a final state boundary condition, I want to review quantum mechanics with final state boundary conditions. This is something which has been developed by Jim and Marie Gell-Mann and others. So let me just remind you of what they did, quantum mechanics with final state. Boundary condition. Then I'll be able to describe our proposal. And then I'll talk about some of its consequences. Okay. So, to start off with this review, we're going to be doing this sort of semi-classical argument. So let's consider, for simplicity, general relativity coupled to a single scalar field on scalar phi. And we first pick a classical solution describing gravitational collapse of the scalar field to a black hole. So one has some Penrose diagram which looks like this. Standard collapse of some matter to a black hole. So you have a classical collapse, and then you quantize the small fluctuations about it. And you assume that initially these quantum fluctuations are all in their ground state or in the vacuum state. So you have some vacuum state in the past, and...
Wait, do you quantize only phi or the coupled phi?
Both. Yeah, we'll include gravitons as part of the possible Hawking radiation. So this state, at later times, is described by something called the Unruh state. So the vacuum goes into the Unruh state, which describes an outgoing flux of energy from the black hole. Now you might be more familiar with the Hartle-Hawking state, but that's of course describing a black hole in equilibrium with its with some thermal radiation. The Unruh state is the quantum state which corresponds to a net flux of outgoing radiation with no incoming radiation coming in from past infinity. Well, once you see this, you can then argue either by a semi-classical Einstein equation argument that the Einstein tensor must be equal to some expectation value of the stress tensor, or just by ordinary energy conservation, that the black hole should lose energy. And so one imagines a sort of Penrose diagram which is more like this, where the black hole loses its mass and disappears. Now, if I take a surface at late times, something like this, I can divide the Hilbert space of this fluctuations into two parts, depending upon whether the states have support inside the horizon or outside the horizon. So we get these two Hilbert spaces, H in and H out. And since Hawking radiation is a pair creation process, the unruh state can be written as a sort of correlated state in the tensor product of the in and out Hilbert spaces. Now, so far, this is, of course, still a pure state. But Hawking argued that if you then go at later times and consider a state up here, the black hole is now gone. And so one has no access to these states, the ingoing Hawking radiation. And therefore, one must trace. Any measurement you do here would have to involve a trace over the ingoing states. So this is, say, sigma prime. We have to trace in. And therefore, you get a density matrix. And so this was Hawking's argument that you have evolution from a pure state to a density matrix, and you lose information. And furthermore, simple causality from this black hole diagram makes it seem, well, very difficult to imagine that any information from what fell into the black hole can affect the outgoing Hawking radiation when you seem to have lost this information. Okay, so that's the standard argument from the semi-classical calculation for information loss. Well, we're not going to, we don't want to modify quantum mechanics to allow pure states to go to mixed states, but we are going to adopt a slight modification of quantum mechanics because we want to be able to impose a final state boundary condition. So let me now review this work of Jim and Murray and others for quantum mechanics with a final state boundary condition. Well, as you know, in quantum mechanics, you can't assign a probability for every history. Okay, the probability, some rules wouldn't be obeyed because of standard quantum mechanical interference. In the usual story, you assign probabilities to histories that are measured. You do a sequence of measurements, and then you compute probabilities. The measurement is supposed to collapse the wave function, destroy the interference, and give you consistent probabilities. But that story doesn't really apply if you want a more complete description, where all the measuring apparatus has to be part of your quantum state. Furthermore, it doesn't apply if you want to describe a region near a singularity, say, where there's no observers around to do any measurement. And so a more complete description of quantum mechanics is in terms of something called decoherence. Or consistent histories, I guess, is the other standard name for this. And so the idea is just the following. So we're going to describe a possible history in terms of projection operators. So alternatives at a moment of time at time t are going to be described in terms of orthogonal projections, where alpha labels the possible values. And so the sum over these projections are complete, so the sum over alpha of P alpha is equal to the identity. A particular history is then just a sequence of these projection operators at some specified times. So you can have, alpha n, you can have some sequence of projection operators, and this whole sequence will be a particular history, which we'll denote by C sub alpha. And the set of histories are a set of things like this, where you allow alpha to take, say, a possible value, do one possible set of histories. So one defines the decoherence functional to be a functional on a pair of histories, which is just the trace of this history, C alpha, rho I, that's a density matrix, times the adjoint of this other history, C alpha prime. Rho is the initial state, which of course could be a pure state. And that'll be the case we're mostly interested in, but it could also be some density matrix if you want to start with some mixed state. Now, histories are said to decohere if the off-diagonal elements of this decoherence functional vanish. So, I guess I should have left this up, but oh well. So the claim is that histories are said to decohere if this is zero or very close to zero for alpha not equal to alpha prime. And when the histories, so first of all, decoherence is a property both of the initial state, your rho, and the dynamics. And when the histories do decohere, you can define probabilities by setting P, the probability for your history, is then just the diagonal element of this decoherence functional. And it's clear that these probabilities sum to 1 because the sum, if you sum over all values of alpha and alpha prime, of the decoherence functional, that clearly gives you the identity, because summing over all alpha and alpha prime, you just basically repeat this n squared times or something, so you get the identity all over, and by normalization, the trace of the density matrix is 1. So this is always 1, and then if the off-diagonal elements are 0, they don't contribute. And so this implies that the sum of the probabilities is 1 for decohering histories.
Okay. Part of the choice here is you're choosing the basis, the alphas, which set of commuting projectors at some fixed time.
Absolutely. So this is like a coarse graining. This is, so it's your set of histories which decohere. And your set of histories involves sort of the choice of times that you're doing it, and your choice of p's, which projection operators you want to consider exactly. Okay, so far this is just ordinary quantum mechanics. This is supposed to be a reformulation of ordinary quantum mechanics in a sort of a way which doesn't make explicit reference to any sort of classical measuring process. But it's obviously time asymmetric in the sense that we are imposing a initial state but no final state. That's the usual story in quantum mechanics. You have an initial state, you evolve through the Schrodinger's equation, you compute probabilities, and that's all there is to the theory. Another way to say it is that you could imagine this has a final state, but the final state is just some identity, sort of total ignorance, nothing in the final state. But, as Jim Hartle and Murray Gell-Mann and others pointed out, it's very easy and natural to generalize this formula to a situation where you do want to impose a final state boundary condition. So we generalize to a density decoherence functional, which now includes a possible final state density matrix as well as an initial state. And so we again have our histories, our initial state, other history. Oh, and we need to impose some normalization factor where n is just 1 over the trace of the last one. Okay, so now this is our modified decoherence functional in the presence of a final state boundary condition. The condition for decoherence is the same as before. Histories will be set to decohere if the off-diagonal elements are 0. And the formula for probabilities is exactly as before. And this probability sum to 1 for the same reason as before. Everything goes through exactly as before. The only difference is that you can't compute probabilities knowing only the initial state and the sort of set of histories. You also need to know what the final state is before you can extract probabilities. You mean in this case with the final state?
The diagonal density matrix. The diagonal, the D of the alpha alphas.
Is that obviously positive? Jim? Yes. Okay.
If you work it out in terms of matrix elements.
Only if the alpha angle turns zero.
Sure, but that's the only case you're interested in interpreting them as probabilities.
By the way, I do not feel the time asymmetric. I mean, if I take the last measurement, the last projector, right, and let's call it PF, I separate it out from this definition. Right. Then the thing is symmetric between PF, which is the rho F, and rho I, which is the usual quantum mechanics condition of the two, saying I have no time direction, I have Heisenberg state, and I have the transition to go from initial to final here, and then I have a chain in between. So why do you say it's time asymmetric?
You certainly can rewrite this in a different way, where you impose some time reversal transformation on it. It's just, I mean, ordinary quantum mechanics we usually think of as sort of specifying an initial state, evolving in time.
Got Heisenberg state. We should not think.
Okay.
But this PF can define a final state.
Yes.
It's meant to be pure because you have one on both sides, alpha and alpha prime.
Well.
So when it's squared, the same thing. You know?
I think it depends on what you think the theory consists of, right? I mean, if you think the theory consists of a Hamiltonian and at the initial state, right? Then you put the initial state at the beginning, right? You stretch out, and there's nothing on the other end. It's quite true what you say. If you think, right, if you just look at the initial state as a projection, you could write it, which it isn't, but you could just write it. There's no difference in formula going one way or backward, but you have to. Your theory consists of specifying one particular element, which is one projection, which is before on one end or the other. In that sense, it's asymmetric.
Okay. So we now want to sort of apply this formalism to the black hole information problem. So this is our proposal. So let's first consider, we're going to fix the mass of the black hole just so we can sort of work with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So fix the black hole mass. And let's consider sort of all possible classical solutions, classical collapse to this black hole. And we want to imagine those possible classical solutions in states as being part of a Hilbert space. So the possible ways of forming the black hole sort of the initial matter states. Black hole will live in some Hilbert space, which we'll call the matter Hilbert space. And so another way of saying what the semi-classical calculation gave was that we end up with a state, semi-classically, we have a state of the matter which collapsed to form the black hole, and then we have the state of the Hawking radiation, which is this Unruh state, U, which is in this tensor product of the ingoing and outgoing Hawking radiation.
Gary, I don't exactly understand what this Hilbert space means. So if I think about, you know, the incoming state is some scattering state that I throw in from infinity. Now, are you saying you want to think of only those initial scattering states that form this black hole and do nothing else, or anything that forms this black hole and does anything else you want someplace else in the universe or someplace in between? Or?
The arguments are certainly cleanest, and what we focused on was the case where our instate comes in and forms a black hole, and that's it. Of course, semi-classically it evaporates and you get Hawking radiation and stuff.
Right.
But I don't want to consider a state where you, you know, come in and form the black hole and also have some stuff which goes out and has nothing to do with the black hole. I mean, you could do that, but that sort of doesn't seem relevant for the black hole.
It's always starting to be true when you form a black hole that some radiation is starting to go off. I mean, all these calculations from Death and Cain and so on have shown. Excuse me.
Well, I mean, not
shown that. In four dimensions, for sure.
You're trying to shoot, you know, produce a black hole by two very high energetic particles. Certainly, we have lots of spherically symmetric collapse of scalar fields, which just come in and form a black hole. And,
if you don't have anything else but gravitons, yeah, spherically symmetric collapse will produce actually gravitational radiation. But I mean, typically, most ways of forming a black hole are going to form something else in addition, and I'm not sure I see how you separate that particular something else from all other possible something else's.
Well, let's come back to this, okay? I mean, I want to sort of give the argument in its cleanest form where we don't have to worry about other stuff coming out first, and then we can see, you know, to what extent it generalizes into that.
A related objection, as you know, is I don't, maybe you want to say something about this now, I mean, but I don't really see how you distinguish the matter Hilbert space from the Unruh Hilbert space.
Yeah.
It's not like the Hawking radiation is made out of separate particles and the matter particle. They're the same particles.
Okay. Well, okay. This is, I don't have a, you know, really clean, as you know, since we discussed this a couple of days.
Maybe you come up with one in the
I don't have a really clean way of separating this. I mean, it seems, in a semi-classical approximation, where this is the stuff which classically collapses to form the black hole, and this is what happens when you quantize the fluctuations about it, you know, they do seem to arise in different ways. In the eternal black hole, there is this killing field, the d by dt killing field, and the ingoing Hawking radiation is supposed to have negative energy as seen by an outside observer, whereas the matter you throw in had better have positive energy as seen by an outside observer. So that does suggest a way of distinguishing the ingoing Hawking quanta and the matter by what eigenvalue they have with respect to this d by dt killing field. So d by dt is space-like inside the horizon, and so it really is more like a momentum to a local observer than an energy. But as far as the outside observer is concerned, whether this is right moving or left moving is the difference between positive and negative energy. And what it turns out to be, actually it's easy to see, the energy is minus the inner product between this killing field and say the momentum, for momentum of your particle. And therefore, if you are moving in this direction, particles which are right moving in this diagram have negative, quote, energy, as seen from the outside observer. So we get this correspondence that the right movers correspond to the Hawking radiation, sort of Hn, and the left movers inside are this sort of H matter. Now, this is sort of a rough statement. When you come to the actual evaporating black hole, you don't have an exact Killing field anymore. And furthermore, as Don pointed out, you can always imagine sort of throwing something in early. So you basically throw it in from the other side of the black hole, and so it ends up bouncing in you know, this sort of classical matter that you're throwing in would end up being a right mover inside the horizon. Yeah. So this is not a precise distinction, and I don't think we have a precise distinction. But the intuition is that in the semi-classical, certainly in the strict semi-classical limit, this is the stuff which became the classical matter which formed the black hole, and this is the stuff which became the partners of the outgoing Hawking radiation. And maybe one can do better. Yeah. In the time-dependent case, That's right. So we're thinking of this in a microcanonical ensemble rather than a sort of a canonical ensemble. But you're right. I mean, what we want this to be is sort of the Hawking radiation in this region. So okay, but coming back to the main point, if we think of this, we have this initial state, which I can just define to be some big initial state psi, and therefore, yeah. They have to have negative energy.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, just from the point of view of where they would move if they fall in, why would they move this way rather than that way?
It's counterintuitive. I mean, I must say, I didn't realize this at first. I mean, naturally you think, well, one of the particles are moving out, the other ones are moving in. They must be doing that. I mean, that's the intuition, yeah. Right? Ingoing Hawking radiation should be moving in. Yeah. That's not what happens. And you can actually see it, you know, if you look carefully at the particle creation calculations, you see that the modes, which are the sort of partners, are actually doing this. But this is a very simple sort of particle-like argument why they have to do that.
They're explicitly in the 2D models.
But I completely agree. It's counterintuitive, but it does offer this nice separation in modulo these subtleties that people keep reminding me of. You know, the stuff you throw in should certainly be, you know, left moving in some sense. And so the Hawking partners could be the right one. But that's the idea. Okay, so where are we? Okay, let me leave that up, and let me go on to how we do this in the context of this decoherence functional. So we're going to start with an initial density matrix, which is a pure state, and it's just that we want to take initially rho is going to be just this density matrix made out of our initial state there. And now we want to impose a final state only on part of the system. Our idea is that this part of the future should have some state, some final state boundary condition, which we'll call the black hole state. And the black hole state, well, let's probably think of it this way, can be expanded in terms of the, say, a basis for the ingoing Hawking radiation and this matter Hilbert space. And so you get something like SMI M in the matter I. And we're going to demand that S is unitary. Unitary matrix. And the idea is
that if you choose your basis to be some natural Fock basis associated with the Hawking radiation and the matter that you can throw in, this matrix is supposed to be very complicated, essentially a random matrix. So in the natural Fock basis,
Gary, these two Hilbert spaces, HM and HI, are supposed to be infinite dimensional, finite dimensional?
Because we fixed the mass of the black hole, we can work with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So they're roughly the black hole.
Why is S even a diagonal matrix?
Okay, so we think of these Hilbert spaces.
I'm sorry, excuse me, I said diagonal, I meant square.
Square, yeah.
Why is it a square matrix? Why do those two Hilbert spaces have the same dimension?
Okay, well, we're assuming that the dimension of the Hilbert space corresponding to waves that form the black hole is of order the entropy of the black hole. And the entropy and the Hilbert space of the outgoing Hawking radiation is also of order the entropy of the black hole. Well, it is larger. I mean, entropy increases, but it's not much larger. It's larger by factors of two or something.
It's larger, but the number of spaces
exponentially
very, very much.
So that would suggest that S is not a square matrix.
It's mostly a phase. I mean, it's larger because of phase space factors. Right? Particles have a lot of room to move around.
It's larger because the thermal ensemble that something gives rise to has much more entropy than the original. If you took, you know, the typical element of the thermal ensemble of outgoing Hawking radiation and ran it backwards, it would not form a black hole. It has much more entropy.
It's not a big difference. It's of order of factor of two or something. But in the number of it makes a big difference in the number of stages.
Isn't that Gary wants to just use those stages which, when run backwards, will form a black hole? He's already cleverly picking out some space of Hilbert space outside the black hole anyway. Why not be a little more clever and pick out just those stages that run backwards in the black hole?
So the outgoing, what you call the outgoing Hawking radiation, is just precisely those states which when run backwards really are the real pure states.
That's certainly the approximation we're working in, because we want to think of these as both being the same dimension of order. So the dimension of all the Hilbert spaces is of order n, which is the black hole entropy, the exponential of the black hole entropy. And this is true for all of them.
Quite frankly, I still don't exactly see why the argument that the entropy should be more or less the same sounds reasonable, but I don't see why they should be exactly the same. And I really, because the entropy is large, seems to me it's not at all clear why this should be a square matrix.
You're saying for every
every way of forming the black hole, whatever precisely that means, there's exactly one state of the Hawking particles that will be produced.
Well, that is what unitary evolution tells us. And the CFT is saying for every state you produce the black hole, you'll get a definite state out. So we're trying to reconcile sort of lesson of ADS CFT with the semi-classical picture. And this seems to be what you're forced to do. Steve?
What was the earlier question? You can't easily separate the matter Hilbert space and the in Hilbert space, since those really are identified. What would this matrix look like in that context? Thought about what kind of object it would be if that's just a single
space, I guess. We believe that the complete description of what's going on is in terms of this dual CFT. Okay, and there you have one Hilbert space and unitary evolution, and everything is clean and precise and well defined. But we now want to sort of translate that into the black hole picture. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we've adopted this strategy of separating the Hawking, ingoing Hawking radiation modes from the matter which forms the black hole. It doesn't sound unreasonable from a semi-classical standpoint, but I agree there are these subtleties which people have been bringing up, and we don't really have an improved description in this language for what to do. I mean, this is a good question for people to think about if they want to pursue this, but we don't really have anything more to say about that.
You see, in the CFT, the dimension of the Hilbert space is infinite, and when I think about a process of making a black hole that, you know, the unitary evolution naturally includes all kinds of processes in which I make a black hole and I make some other stuff as well, and if things, you know, somehow don't exactly match, all right, as far as, you know, exactly matching the dimension of the Hilbert space you associate with the black hole entropy, you can say, okay, that's fine, it's still unitary because, you know, this corresponds to some number of particles that were created at the same time that I created the black hole but never fell in. So that you can't, here you're seemingly forcing yourself into a much tighter box.
But in the CFT, if you fix the energy, yeah, you do have a finite number of states. And so we're working in sort of a sector of fixed energy. So there's really no, I mean, you can sort of do this with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces in the CFT.
Well, it's ADS space, so it's ADS over coordinates, so the levels are
discrete. They're all discrete.
That's probably kind of.
Okay, so we expect that this matrix appearing in this black hole state will be very complicated, essentially a random matrix. And as Juan said in his talk at the conference, it's tempting to imagine that this random matrix might in some sense be related to the random matrix which should be describing the actual dynamics of a generic approach to a singularity. As Thibault has described, Thibault has been telling us that generic approach to singularities are, classically is chaotic. You get a lot of these. And so, I don't know. If you're not tempted by it, you don't have to buy it. But we find it intriguing that well, we expect it to be very complicated. And you'll see in a minute that because of its sort of complication or randomness, you can recover basically the thermal expectation values for observers outside. But that's the motivation. Yeah. Right.
Does that include smaller black holes? So a smaller black hole plus one electron. Is that one of the states?
We're imagining that we're starting with a state which is not a black hole. If you want to form a smaller black hole first and then throw it in, I guess you could do it in stages.
But that's dominant.
Well, a smaller black hole plus one particle will never have the same energy as a big black hole. We need a small black hole plus one particle.
Very slightly. Very, very slightly. That's most of the ways you can form the bigger black holes by a very, very slightly smaller.
No, but we're assuming that there are as many states, many ways to form the smaller black hole as is given by the smaller black hole's entropy. So you don't really gain anything, right? You might as well just start looking at those states before you form the smaller black hole.
But it's been very hard, right, to actually identify matters. Such a large number of matter states that would form a black hole of that area. You just try to form it.
You do it by induction. I mean, if you make a small hole plus one, I mean, it's just a sequence of particles flying.
Building up Planck-sized black holes. Now, I agree. This is not something that one could sort of start out from the classical theory and try to count very easily. But, you know, I repeat, the CFT is telling us that this is sort of right, that, you know, we should be able to count the states in the CFT of this given energy and find it somehow. Anyway, going ahead, so what do we got? We have a state which is some final state on the inside of the black hole, but we don't want to assume anything about the outside, which means that we have in the sort of decoherence functional approach a final state rho f, which is the density matrix corresponding to the black hole state or the inside of the black hole cross the identity, complete ignorance, or the outside, Hawking radiation. So you now plug in our initial density matrix, which I remind you is a pure state coming from here, with and the final state density matrix into the decoherence functional. And let's ask, what are the probabilities of alternatives outside the black hole? So if you construct your histories now, C, only to involve alternatives outside the black hole, so if C sort of only involves P out, then it's a short calculation to show that this what do you mean complete? It is, we have a set of alternatives which sum to one associated with you know, alternatives in the outgoing Hawking radiation. They sum to one out, yes.
But that's this normalization factor, right? This 1 over trace rho f rho.
Yeah, that's right. If you put that in so things stay normal.
Loss of probability.
That's right. And so what this tells you, or what you discover, is that this density matrix, basically the trace of n times the trace of rho f c out, rho I c out alpha prime, that is equal to, it's equal to a formula with the same projections and just a, say, initial density matrix, where this is actually a pure state. So this is some psi tilde, and psi tilde is it's equal to, just from working it out, S, this matrix SMI, sort of the components of this matter state that we start with M in this basis, little m, times the out state. And because we can rewrite the sort of all the probabilities for the observer outside in terms of the usual quantum mechanics starting with the pure state, this is as if we had unitary evolution from psi m into this state psi tilde. And in fact, if you stare at this, this is very, since S is unitary, this is very much like this. I'm going to just use completeness of this basis, and it's very much like acting with a unitary operator on this and getting a state in the out Hilbert space. So that's the sense in which one can say to recover unitary evolution in this approach. Okay, well, I don't have too much time left. Let me discuss some of the consequences of this proposal. Okay. We did not need anything about randomness to say this. What we do need it for is to say that this state will now reproduce the same thermal expectation values that you would get in the usual Hawking calculation for sufficiently coarse-grained observables. Okay, so if you sum over enough of the sort of matrix elements, because of the randomness here, this will reproduce the thermal expectation values. That's where it comes from.
So, Gary?
Yeah.
Because it's unitary, you can literally run across backwards. And there should be a way of knowing that if you have some certain state of incoming radiation, they're finely tuned to actually make a white hole when they come together. Is there any way to know what, obviously it's all sorts of substrates, but any way of characterizing what state they're supposed to be?
You want to run the clock backwards and take alkaline Hawking radiation with future infinity and run it back? Because, of course, ordinary radiation, you throw it together, it's going to form a black hole.
Right, so it's just like a unitary process going from a scattering state to outgoing Hawking radiation. Since it's unitary, I can go back.
Okay.
You have to add in the black hole stuff.
Yeah, you got to add in the black hole stuff. So I guess...
No, I don't. White hole.
Well, this was calculated using this final state. So obviously... This formalism, where did it go? This thing, you know, I can turn the clock around, reinterpret this as some initial state, this as some final state, reorder the operators, and get the same answer. So
I'm saying that's I can draw a sigma that goes from state like infinity to before the event horizon.
Yeah.
You have a unitary map from sigma 1 or sigma 5 up there to that. And that. I shouldn't need any extra information.
It's a unitary matrix, but it's not a unitary Hamiltonian process.
Right.
You can't use the Hamiltonian, the quantum field theory Hamiltonian, on the radiation. Apply that Hamiltonian as your time evolution operator, run it backwards and get the matter state.
Right, but given the information on the what is here the final state, I should be able to predict with certainty that I would get a white hole.
If you just turn this picture upside down, okay, then there should be a way of resaying everything I've said with the white hole and the boundary condition at the white hole. Okay, so I agree with you on that. But if you turn it upside down, then it's like, well, the stuff in the future is what you start with, and the stuff in the past.
Then the black hole is sort of the state that you can want.
Well, then it's more like an initial state. It's more like an initial state, exactly. So then you have an initial state on here and on here, and you're evolving it in time reverse.
It's not in my initial state. It's in my knowledge that the way I evolve my initial state involves a boundary condition I will put in on extra parts of the initial state to come into existence. But otherwise, it's not unitary.
Okay, let me just leave. I mean, I think there is a way of time reversing everything. And so what you get when you time reverse is what you get. Okay, consequences. Let me just mention two. You might think that because we're imposing a definite final state, that observers that sort of fall into the black hole will see time running backwards. They'll somehow see thermodynamics running backwards. And we argue that that doesn't happen because anybody who falls in has access to a very small subset of the total number of degrees of freedom inside the black hole. There's only a finite time before the observer hits the singularity, only a finite sort of region of space that you can sort of access. So because of that, you have to trace over all the other sort of degrees of freedom here that the observer is not going to have access to. And that can restore essentially complete ignorance for your final boundary condition. And the easiest way to see that is that if you have an observer inside who only does measurements on the matter Hilbert space, then you have to sum over all of the states in the ingoing Hawking radiation, and that reproduces a density matrix. The final state, so if you only sort of consider alternatives for HM, then you get a final state density matrix, which involves the sum over the ingoing Hawking radiation, well, and of course the outgoing Hawking radiation, because this is the river inside the horizon. And if you just do this, starting with the final state density matrix that we started with, this reproduces basically complete ignorance for the matter Hilbert space.
You get something like that.
So you will not see, you do not see time going backwards.
running backwards. And finally, there is a sense in which this proposal has sort of can be viewed as information bouncing off the singularity. So let me describe that. So there.
It wouldn't be a bad thing to have time running backwards. I'd like to see it run backwards myself.
We'll work on that. We're very motivated.
Can we throw you a black hole with that?
Okay, so this is sort of not precise, but sort of roughly rough information flow I want to claim is this. We have our semi-classical geometry with the matter. Oops, what am I doing? Horizon is here, matter is here. So the idea is that the information flows with the matter into the black hole, bounces off the singularity. The antiparticles, which are the Hawking partners of the radiation we see, can be viewed as sort of going backwards in time, and then with the Hawking creation event, they get scattered into the outgoing real particles that we see. Now, this isn't just a picture. One can do the following calculation. So let's consider the state that we're starting with. We have a state which is our matter state, and we have the unruh state. And let's imagine taking, you know, considering some alternatives. So we have alternatives in the, make sure I get this in the right. Okay, so let's start with P matter, P in, P out. And at the moment, these projection operators all commute. They can be written in any order. So the ordering here is arbitrary. This is arbitrary order. That's the way we start. And now we just, okay, let's expand U in the basis, and let's introduce a matrix where U is some uij, I prime, j prime, times some in states and some out states. Okay, in the basis that I just wrote down, the usual Hawking basis, this would just be an identity matrix, but we can consider a general basis if you want. Okay, so U is just the matrix describing the correlations in the Hawking radiation. And now I'm going to insert a complete set of basis elements in here and rewrite these operators in terms of their matrix elements. And I claim what we get is the following. So if you just write these in terms of matrix elements, we have on the end U, I prime, J prime, then we have these P out, J, J prime, P in, I prime. Then we have the sort of components of this state. So this is psi M, M prime. Then we have P M, M prime. And then we have the other basis state. So this is M, I in, and J out. So now we want to impose our final state boundary condition. We want to basically impose the black hole final state. And the black hole final state essentially replaces this with our matrix S. That's what the final state of the black hole does. And so now you just rewrite this as matrix multiplication. Okay, forget about the different Hilbert spaces. Let's just see what this looks like in terms of matrix multiplication. And what you have is the state psi. You have, okay, psi has an index m prime. Then you look over here, and you get p, and this is pm. And then you get an index m, and you have a... this psi? This one? No, this doesn't come from S. This comes from psi. So this, right here. Oh, that's what I mean, because this thing is just M prime psi. M And I'm going to sum over the m primes here. Okay, so that's okay. And now I have an m, so I have to write this as an s transpose. And then I have an I, and so I look around and I have to write this as the transpose of the in operator. And I have an I prime, and so I have this transpose of u. And I have a j prime, and so I have p out. And that's it. So you notice that the calculation of this, this contribution to the probability now puts these operators in a very definite order. And it really is, you have the psi coming in from the observations on the matter. S is the sort of singularity state. You can then, observations of the ingoing Hawking radiation afterwards. U is the Hawking creation process. And P is the outgoing, observation of the outgoing Hawking radiation. Let me just finish. And so this has connections with the black hole complementarity ideas that Lenny Susskind and others talked about many years ago, because their resolution of the black hole information puzzle was that operators outside and operators inside should not commute, even though they're at quoted space-like separations. We see a sign of that here, because it's quite likely that these operators won't commute because this matrix S is very complicated. And in fact, you can think of this as a consequence of decoherence. It's unlikely that, generic measurements here and here, alternatives would decohere because of our black hole final state. And let me stop there. Thank you.